Thanks a lot for the introduction and the hospitality. So I'm Ziqing Yang from Boston University, and today I'm going to talk about our recent work. It's actually a series of work on entanglement complexity and scrambling via braiding of non-abelians. Let me just briefly mention my collaborators: Claudio Shimon, my advisor, of course; Eduardo Mocciolo, he's a professor at University of Central Florida; Alyosha Hama, he is currently at UMass Boston; Konstantinos, actually, let me not try his last name. Konstantinos is actually a postdoc in University of Leeds. Stefanos Curtis is currently a postdoc at Boston University. Now, basically, the quantity that we shall be focusing on in this work is the so-called entanglement spectrum. So before I start with the going a little bit more in detail about the motivation, let me just be a bit clear. What do I mean by the entanglement spectrum? Now, in this work, we shall only be considering a pure state. Now, suppose we have a pure state, then we can always write it in terms of some local basis. For example, think of we have a spin system or a qubit system where the sigma denotes the configuration of the entire system, that I can always write in terms of the local basis, and then psi of sigma is just a wave function. And now, under a bipartitioning of the system into subsystem A and B, I can always group the configuration into the configuration subsystem A and B, and then I can do the same thing for the psi, for the wave function. And now, once I have the psi sigma A sigma B, I can recast that into a matrix whose dimension is the Hilbert space dimension of subsystem A by the Hilbert space dimension of subsystem B. And then once I have that, I can do a Schmidt decomposition, also known as a singular value decomposition of the matrix psi. And then I get a set of singular values on the diagonal. The collection of lambda k is the quantity that I'm going to call the entanglement spectrum. And what, by the way, the psi doesn't have to be a square matrix. It's depending on the how you bipartition your system. And let me just mention how this is related to the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. The reduced density matrix, for example, of subsystem A, is obtained by taking the wave function and then taking the state and then trace over the degrees of freedoms in subsystem B, and then you get the role of A. So it turns out that actually the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix P of K is nothing but the square of the singular values of the Schmidt decomposition of psi. So the more familiar quantity, maybe the entanglement entropy or the Von-Neumann entropy, can be obtained from the entanglement spectrum by basically a trace of rho log rho, and this is basically sum over k lambda k squared log of lambda k squared. Let me briefly mention an alternative definition that just to avoid confusion, and not that it's going to be important or used at all in this work. Sometimes in the literature, people define the entanglement spectrum in a different way by rewriting the reduced density matrix as exponential of minus of some operator h of e, and then h of e is known as the entanglement Hamiltonian sometimes. And then, so the energy spectrum of HE, CK, is what sometimes people define as the entanglement energy or the entanglement spectrum. So in our case, we just take the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix without taking the log. It turns out that for our purpose, it doesn't really make any difference. But sometimes people talk about the low energy sector or high energy sector. Actually, that's what they mean. So. Okay, now if you look at the entanglement spectrum and the entropy, you'll find that the entropy, this is a very compact way of characterizing the property of the system by getting a single number out of the full spectrum, lambda k. But then you could also wonder, okay, on the one hand, you have a full spectrum, you have a full spectrum of all the singular values, but then you get a single number. Could there be additional information contained in the full spectrum that is not captured by the entanglement entropy alone? Or, it's captured, but it's hidden in some way that is not so transparent. Historically, this problem was first, I think, was first addressed by Haldane and Li. But there, they were looking at the ground state, the entanglement spectrum of ground states of gapped systems. And then, for example, they look at the Moreau-Ried wave functions and you know some actual wave function of the fractional quantum Hall state from exact diagonalization. And then they found that the entanglement spectrum of such a state is basically, it contains information about the edge excitations. And so from then on, people start to propose that the entanglement spectrum in such cases does include information, for example, characteristics of the topological order of the system. And now in this work, basically we're gonna ask the same thing, but now we want to extend to not the ground states of a gap system at all, but for highly excited states. By highly excited states, I mean, because for ground states of gap systems, the entanglement entropy basically scales only at the as the area of the subsystem. So the amount of entanglement is low. It's actually far away from the maximum. By highly excited states, I mean states that that typically feature volume law entanglement entropy. Even more than that, actually saturates the maximum entropy for a given Hilbert space dimension. So the question is, does these kind of states, the entanglement spectrum of these kinds of states, encode more information than the entanglement spectrum, than the entanglement entropy, just as in the case of the ground states? This is the question that we're trying to address. Now, the first question is, okay, how to extract the information contained in the spectrum of such highly excited states? And there, I think at the beginning, well, it's important to notice one difference between ground states of gap system and the highly entangled states. So the ground state of gap systems, the entanglement is low. If you look at the entanglement spectrum, the spectrum is usually decays very fast, often exponentially, and often separated by, you know, often separated by a large gap in the Schmidt norms, because if you look at the entanglement entropy, the entropy is maximized when the entanglement spectrum is flat, meaning that it's all equal to 1 over the Hilbert space dimension of the subsystem size, meaning that the entanglement spectrum is really flat. So the faster that the entanglement spectrum decays, typically, the lower the amount of the entanglement is. For example, if you take a product state which is unentangled, the entropy is 0, and then if you look at the spectrum, you'll find that there is only one eigenvalue that is not 0, which is equal to 1. So in such systems, it is natural to expect that if there is any universal physics, it should be encoded in a low energy sector of the entanglement spectrum, because these are the ones with the dominating weights, whereas the rest are basically 0 to some extent. But this is not the case for highly entangled state that typically feature volume law entanglement entropy. If you look at the entanglement spectrum, you'll find that they're usually continuous and decays fairly slowly. Usually if you look at the density of states, you find that there is no such a gap separating some of the low-lying. There is no such a sensible notion of low energy sector versus. So there, if you want to extract any information, you really have to look at the information encoded in the full spectrum or a significant fraction of the spectrum. So therefore, we invoke the so-called level spacing statistics that's typically used in, for example, random matrix theory in the early studies of, for example, chaotic systems, to as a diagnostics of these kind of the entanglement spectrum of these kind of states.
So can you clarify something? What do you mean by the decay of the entanglement spectrum?
Meaning that because the entanglement spectrum is basically a collection of all of the lambda k's, right? Of all the Schmidt norm, singular values. And now suppose if I rank order the lambda k's in descending order in such a way that lambda 1 is greater than lambda 2 is greater than, So basically if you plot the spectrum and see how fast it decays.
Mm-hmm. What are you trying to diagnose?
What distribution of the level spacing statistics of the entanglement spectrum it shows.
What are you trying to extract from that?
That is coming soon.
But is there an intuition? What question are you trying to ask?
Basically, you're trying to say an answer is, could there be, for example, could there be distinct states that are almost maximally entangled, meaning that the entanglement entropy almost saturates to its maximum value, yet they're different. But then it's just the entropy cannot tell it. Because, for example, if I compute the
the entropy cannot tell.
Yes. But then, how does the entanglement spectrum tell, and what does it mean? That's the question.
Is it related to a Hamiltonian, or
It could be related depending on how you generate the states. Actually, in the case, I'm going to show examples of both. And the first case is that you can consider, for example, highly entangled state generated out of a random unitary circuit, which certainly doesn't have a Hamiltonian. Also, you can study Hamiltonian evolution. So let me just briefly mention some of the quantities that are
In the case of the ground state, the entanglement spectrum is supposed to tell something about the eight states.
Yes.
You have to construct.
Yes, yes.
So is there any physical meaning like that here?
Here we don't it's not clear. Yeah, this is why we don't bother taking the log, because the entanglement Hamiltonian doesn't really have a we don't really know how to interpret that. Mm-hmm. Okay, now let me just briefly mention the thing that we're going to use to characterize the spectrum of the basically the entanglement spectrum. Now suppose I rank order all of the singular values lambda k in descending order, so that, as I said, lambda 1 is greater than lambda 2 and greater than lambda 3, etc. And then I define this quantity r, which is the ratio of adjacent gaps in the spectrum. Lambda k minus 1 minus lambda k is the gap, and then, well, basically the ratio of adjacent gaps. And then it turns out the probability distribution of this quantity is different for spectra exhibiting different distributions. And let me just give two expressions for the case that's going to be relevant for this talk. If the spectrum or if the of the eigenvalues are Poisson distributed, the probability distribution is given of these ratio of adjacent gaps is given by this form. And then if it's Vigna-Dyson distributed, which is the random matrix theory description, is given by this complicated form. The particular form is not, well, let me just briefly mention the feature, some features of these two distributions. And the first thing is, if you look at the distribution, probability distribution for r equals to 0, r equals to 0 meaning that you have two singular values that are, you know, falling on top of one another. In the case of Poisson distribution, you'll find that p of r equals to 0 is 1, whereas in the case of Vigna-Dyson distribution, you'll find that p of r equals to 0 is 0. So this tells us that the probability that you're going to find two eigenvalues that fall right on top of the other is suppressed. I mean, that somehow, this is, by the way, this is known as level repulsion, and it means that somehow the energy spectrums are somehow the spectra sort of know the presence of each other in such a way that they want to repel. Whereas for the Poisson distributed, it's actually quite different. So that difference is drastic. And of course, the Z and beta take different values depending on different ensembles, well, depending on whether you have time reversal or not. And also, other than the probability distribution for r equals to 0, if you look at the tails for a large r, the tails of the distribution are also markedly different. If you take r goes to infinity, you'll find that the p of r for Poisson distribution decays as r to the minus 2. Whereas for the Vigna-Dyson distribution, it decays as r to the minus beta minus 2. For example, for a unitary ensemble, this one decays as r to the minus 4. So if you look at the tails of the distribution, it also decays with a different power. So these are all features of these distributions that you can... Yes?
Is it really important that you found both perspectives? Here
it's actually not very... if you look at the way that I'm computing the quantity that I'm using, usually in random matrix theory, you just study the ratio of the gaps that is normalized, not the ratio, just the gap, the distribution of the gaps normalized by some mean value, and there it's important to do folding, but here if you look at the ratio of adjacent gaps, you sort of eliminate the effect of the non-uniformity in the density of state. So here, that's basically one reason that you look at this quantity. It's exactly because you don't have to do spectral unfolding. Yeah, I don't even know how to do spectral unfolding. Anyway,
with your definition, if two levels have the same energy, mm-hmm. and some ratios are infinity as well, right?
Yes. Some ratios are infinity. Yes, right.
Does that mean that in the larger limit, for example, Poisson distribution has finite probability when R is zero. Don't you expect a non-zero probability for R equal to infinity as well?
Yeah, I think, well, I don't have a very rigorous answer, but I think that the answer is that, you know, if we have, no, actually, let me. I don't have an answer to this question. I think it has to do with the thing with the way that you take the ratio in such a way that it's not symmetric, that this something appears in the denominator. If you rank order these thing, in such a way that somehow when you take the ratio that probably it's not symmetric in the sense that you get a finite ratio when this thing appears on the denominator, but that's not very precise. I don't know. Yeah. But I think that the case for this expression for the Poisson distributed spectrum is exact. Yeah.
Rk is zero, then Rk minus one is infinite.
Yeah, but the. But I'm saying that.
Really going to be strictly zero. It's a small value that gets converted into some big quantity.
It also has to do with whether I'm saying that the fact that it appears on the denominator, because then or once that thing appears in the denominator, it has to do with the numerator, right? So I don't really know. Maybe what happens is like the numerator are small in such a way that you always get a small like it's not symmetric in the way that it appears, that you get some finite result when you have when that appears when the zero appears in the denominator. But yeah, actually I'm not really sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or if there are finite number of accidental degeneracies,
right,
the thermal limit they disappear.
Yeah, but then the zeros should also, cannot be substantial. Yeah, so I think that it's the answer is maybe more than that. But yeah, let me not. But in any case, the expression for the Poisson, I think this one is a surmise. But then I think for Poisson distribution, this one is. I think this is exact that you can. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, this is a question that we want to address. As I said, does the entanglement spectrum of highly excited states encode more information than the entanglement entropy? And then, of course, I'm going to give examples to say that to answer this question in the affirmative. The first example I'm going to spend more time discussing, and the second I'm going to go through briefly. The first example is the time evolution of a random unitary circuit. So basically, this is to say that what is the highly excited state or highly entangled state that we're talking about? Basically, this is the state evolved under a random unitary circuit. So here, I draw pictorially a random unitary circuit, with each string represents a qubit, and the arrow of time goes from bottom to the top, and so that at the bottom, imagine you have some product state. And then it undergoes the unitary evolution of the circuit in a layer by layer fashion. And each blue sort of the brick wall represents a gate acting on two qubits. Here we're only considering local gates. And in this, from now on, for the initial state, we're always going to take random product states, meaning that the product states, but it could happen with you know, random phases and things like.
You're focusing here only on one-dimensional.
Yes.
System.
Right. It's one-dimensional. Then, of course, to fully specify the circuit, then you have to specify what are the gates that that makes up the circuit. And of course, different choices of gate sets, it corresponds to different classes of circuits with different functionalities. Here, well, in quantum computing, there is this notion of universal versus non-universal computation. Universal gate sets are basically gates that are capable of approximating any unitary operator to arbitrary precision. If a finite set of gates can achieve this property, we say that these gate sets are capable of universal quantum computation. If it doesn't, then this is non-universal. One example of universal quantum universal sets of gates are given by the following: is the Hadamard gate, a pi over 8 gates, and the C naught gates. So out of the three, the Hadamard and pi over 8, or sometimes called the T gates, these two gates are single qubit gates. Because if you look at the, if you read it in terms of matrices, you see that it's a 2x2 matrix. So it's actually operating on a single qubit. And the C naught gate is a 2-qubit gate. So now let me look at the T gates first. And the T gates, T gate is basically written in this form. So up to a global phase vector, this is nothing but a sigma z rotation of with the angle of pi over 8. And then here, the Hadamard gate, I'm not going to show here, but this is basically some sort of, it's not a single rotation, but it's a rotation. It's a composition of a rotation around x-axis and y-axis. These two things are single qubit gates. And C naught gate is a 2-qubit gates do people all know like what is a C naught gate? Okay, I don't have to explain. Basically, well, it's a controlled naught gate that acts on 2-qubit. It's gonna act as a naught on the second qubit only if the control qubit is one. And well, the reason why these two things are universal can be understood in the way that in order to be able to approximate any arbitrary unitary operator, you'd better be able to generate arbitrary single qubit rotations. And then it turns out that you can show that if you conjugate the T with the H, you can generate some rotation angles on the Bloch sphere that is some irrational number, so that you can densely cover the Bloch sphere, so that you can generate any arbitrary single qubit rotations out of these two. So okay, this is the commonly used universal gates, and of course, for non-universal gates, that you have different choices. So I'm going to give one example. Here is the well-known Clifford circuit that's generated by Hadamard C naught as well. But now instead of a pi over 8, I have a pi over 4 gate. Sometimes it's called an S gate. And if you look at the form of the gate, instead of a pi over 4 here, I have a pi over 2. So instead of the up to some global phases, you can find that this is actually a rotation around sigma z by pi over 4. And now it turns out that this set of gates are not capable of universal quantum computing, precisely for the reason that the single qubit rotation angles are restricted. And in fact, it was even proved that the Clifford circuit can be simulated efficiently on a classical computer. This is another implication that the Clifford circuit better not be, capable for universal quantum computing. Now, we are going to study random product states evolved under random circuits of these two cases, either universal sets of gates or Clifford gates. And now here, we are not going to ask about whether it's capable of universal or not, but we only ask about the entanglement property. First, let's look at the entanglement entropy growth under these two circuits. I don't have the labels for the y-axis, but basically, this plot shows the growth of entanglement under the universal sets of gates, and this one shows the entanglement growth under the Clifford circuit. So the vertical axis is basically the entanglement entropy, and the two curves correspond to the Rényi the von Neumann entropy and the Rényi zero entropy, which basically counts the rank of the subsystem dimension. So you can see that the entanglement growth behavior is pretty much the same for these two cases. And especially if you look at the Clifford circuit, if you look at the final entropy, it turns out this is maximal as well. It's the same as when you pull out pick a hard random state out of the Hilbert space and then you compute its entanglement entropy. It's basically n log 2. That's what I mean by maximum up to some order 1 corrections. So the entanglement growth behaviors are identical in both cases. So Clifford circuit can also maximal entangle random product states. So from that, it seems like it's sort of generating as if it's a random state. It's maximum entangled, but
is this a 16-qubit?
Yes. Yes.
And why is that a line of separating plate?
No, the other one is the Rényi zero.
So I thought all random entropies saturated to this, maximum amount is always the same.
No, because Rényi zero basically counts that's going to saturate to 8, right?
Which one?
This one, the blue, the solid line.
It's which Rényi, which one is it?
The solid line is the Rényi zero. I should have put in caption here. And the red one is the von Neumann entropy.
Well, I thought they all saturate to the same.
No. It's not the same.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because forget it. I was trying to find it. Oh, here, yeah, of course. Yeah, because the Rényi entropy is basically 1 over n. Raised to the power of n. So basically, when n equals to 0, this is what is basically counting the rank. So for example, if you have a system size, so for the Rényi 0, this one is basically log of 2 to the number of qubits of, here I think it's taken log base 2, but yes. And then this is, right. And then,
for a flat distribution, all the other Rényi entropies will give you the same.
No, this is not a flat distribution. Yeah, this is a, I see what you mean. The system, okay. For the von Neumann entropy, because there is an order one correction. Yeah, sorry. For the von Neumann entropy, actually, von Neumann entropy in this case would be, the maximum would be n a log 2 minus, actually, depending on how you bipartition your system. Because if you bipartition your system in such a way that your subsystem A is way smaller than subsystem B, and then indeed it saturates to this value. But then if you, for example, you take an equal bipartitioning, and it turns out that there is a finite order 1 correction, which is 1/2. So that's why you see the deviation. Yeah. Yeah, I should have put the captions. Okay, so the entropy is basically probing the amount of entanglement. This is actually not a good indicator because in a sense that you cannot really tell as if you generate a hard random state that is maximally entangled. So what about the entanglement spectrum? And now if I look at the entanglement spectrum of the final states when the entropy saturates, for the universal sets of gates, you find that the entanglement spectrum is given by a random matrix distribution, and more precisely, a Gaussian unitary ensemble. However, if you look at the spectrum for the generated out of the Clifford circuit, you see a Poisson distribution. As I said, these two distributions are drastically different. And also, let me just say here that the same results holds for, actually, I think we studied another sets of another choice of non-universal gates. Is instead of Clifford's circuit, we study a circuit generated out of the H plus T plus naught, and then you find the same thing. And usually in the case of, For example, the eigenenergies of the Hamiltonian, the fact that you have a Poisson distribution usually indicates some sort of integrability, or the fact that you have some conserved quantities in the system. Basically, in some sense, that the system is simple, that it's basically some filling up some non-uncorrelated single particle orbits. That's the case. But now, since in this case, as I said, that we don't really have a clear understanding of what does the entanglement Hamiltonian mean. But then you could also ask, okay, does it imply something about the complexity of the state, like whether the way that they're entangled is simple or complex? But then how do you make this more precise? So we define this entanglement complexity in the following sense. Namely, whether or not one can efficiently disentangle the state without precise knowledge of the time evolution operator. What does it mean? It means that, now suppose I give a certain realization of a Clifford circuit, and I start from a product state, and then I evolve until at some point, the entanglement entropy saturates. But then I don't really tell you what's the precise realization of the circuit that I'm using to get there. And I ask the question, okay, now that the state is maximally entangled, can you do something to disentangle the state to a product state? Of course, then I don't tell you the circuit so that you cannot apply U dagger to bring it back. We know that there is a U dagger, but then if you do a brute force search, the search space is going to be exponential. And in particular, for generically maximally entangled states generated by a chaotic system, this asking if you can efficiently disentangle the state without precise knowledge is a highly non-trivial task if the system is chaotic, because you can, it's almost impossible to bring it back. Even there's only some sort of a tiny imperfection in your naive guess about the unitary operation. But then we're gonna be bold enough to try this anyway. Now we use the following disentangling algorithm. The algorithm works as the following. Suppose you reach the final states that is maximally entangled. On that states, you randomly pick a site, and then you randomly pick a gate, and then you apply to the final states. And you get a new state, and then you compute the entanglement entropy of that new state. And if the entropy decreases, you accept the move. If it increases, you accept with a certain probability. So this is really like viewing the entropy as an energy. So this is a Metropolis algorithm, like people do in thermal annealing. So this is why we call this an entanglement cooling algorithm. And correspondingly, you can call the fact that the entanglement growth is the entanglement heating period. And just one tiny thing that, here when computing the entropy after you apply the gate, you really have to compute the entropy of under all possible bipartitioning of the system instead of cutting in the middle. Even though the thing that you want to minimize is the one that cuts in the middle, because if you apply a gate that only works on subsystem A, maybe you cut in the middle and then this one is not going to change. And let's see how it works in both cases. So for the Clifford circuit, the red curve, well, as the color suggests, is the entanglement heating period, meaning that you start entangling from a random product state until a point that it saturates. The blue curve is the entanglement cooling algorithm after you apply this sort of Metropolis algorithm. You see that for the Clifford circuit, you really bring it back to, you can really disentangle just by applying this algorithm, even though you don't really know the circuit realization. Whereas for the universal sets of gates, it basically stays there. It doesn't even decrease. It doesn't even fluctuate much. So you can find that using this disentangling algorithm, one can efficiently disentangle the states generated by Clifford circuit, which is also maximally entangled, provide the von Neumann entropy, but not for the universal computation circuits. So this is a very drastic difference between these two cases. That says something that even though the amount of the entropy is the same, but the state is somehow different, and this can be diagnosed very clearly from the entropy.
Is the set of disentangling rates, are they chosen from the
paper? Yes, right.
So isn't that like building an algorithm,
No, but you also know the information for that gate, for that case, right? You had the same amount of information. That I tell. I also tell you that I had evolved from this set of gates.
Let me ask you another question. Mm-hmm. In the first case, you produce states starting from a proper state by applying different. Suppose that after you have your entangled state, you apply a random one qubit rotation to the qubit. Now you try to disentangle with the same set of disentangling gates. Will you succeed?
You only apply single qubit rotations, right?
Yes, that would be
true.
No, the single qubit rotations didn't change the entangled spectrum at all.
Right, right.
The chances are that then you cannot disentangle anymore.
Yes, but okay. I haven't tried. I don't know, but I would say no. Why? Because
you've seen all what, sorry?
No, I would say that it would still be able to disentangle. Because remember, the initial product state that I start from is not just all zeros or all ones, it's a random product state. So at the beginning, I already feed in the initial state some random angles,
yes, but
some random phases.
The evolution, not necessarily.
Not necessarily a commute. Yeah, but, well, I would still expect that the random phases in this case probably doesn't matter as much, but I don't know. Yeah, I shouldn't say much about things that I haven't tried, to be safe. Yeah, if you try and then tell me all it works, it's gonna be embarrassing. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah. Right. Basically, so you see that these two cases are different. Actually, this, let me just mention something that is intimately, that's very closely related to what we are trying to say here. Because what we're trying to say here essentially is like, there are states in the Hilbert space that if you look at the entanglement entropy, it's almost maximal, but they are not completely random states. Meaning that there's a hierarchy in the degree of randomness out of the states that are seemingly maximally entangled. So I think this is some related work done by Ziwen in the audience. So if you have any questions, grill him, not me. This is the so-called entropic scrambling or randomness complexity. Because in this case, we were only looking at the, well, Rennie zero, but then mostly the von Neumann entropy. So naturally, one could say, well, what if I, instead of looking at the von Neumann entropy, I look at the Rennie entropies of higher moments? Does it probe anything? You know, because, well, does it probe the finer structure of the spectrum by looking at the Rennie entropies? So basically, they were trying to study the Rennie entropies and the randomnesses of pure states. And because we know that there are certain ensembles that are not quite hard random, but they can reproduce hard random measure up to certain moments, and these are known as quantum designs. So very important results that they were able to show in the paper is that for alpha designs, the Rennie alpha entropy is almost maximal. So what does it mean? Because we know that for alpha designs are not truly hard random, but then if you look at the Rennie alpha entropy, for all Rennies up to alpha, with indices smaller than alpha, it's almost maximal. So it means that if you just look at the Rennie entropy to a certain order, you won't be able to tell that these two things are actually not random. So there's actually a hierarchy between the saturations of certain generalized entanglement entropies and the randomness of the states. Just to draw some connection with our work, we consider the Clifford circuit, and Clifford group is known to be a unitary 3 design. And then from their result, you can see that the von Neumann entropy is nearly maximal. So this is why that, you know, if you look at the entropy, you won't be able to tell. And here we're showing that the entanglement spectrum statistics probe the degrees of randomness in a way similar to the Rennie entropies with higher moments.
If your subsystem size is much smaller than the system size, then wouldn't you expect that your density matrix, I mean, the spectrum is always flat?
Yes, I think so.
In that case, the spectrum is not useful either.
Yeah, no. You have to probe some. Yeah, it's almost like you know, if you choose your Yeah, this is almost like, well, in the sense of thermalization, right? It's always a statement about local operators, but then, you know, talking about the state itself or with the finite bar partitioning is a different question.
So in that case, there's no distinction between
you. Yeah, I think so.
Universal or non-universal.
I think so. Yeah, yes. Maybe locally you cannot tell.
To your subsystem is at least half of the total system.
No, not at least, maybe a significant fraction, I would say.
It's less than half. In the thermodynamic limit, isn't the spectrum always flat?
Okay, in the thermodynamic limit, meaning that you always take 2 to the Na minus Nb, and then this one is yeah, right.
Not necessarily. For any alpha here, be a ready alpha entropy, you can always have a spectrum that one of the eigenvalues is larger than the other. So it's not necessarily flat.
Because space of subsystem is much smaller than the full hyperspace.
Yeah, the size doesn't really matter. You can always design a spectrum that for any alpha, the Ray alpha is maximal. But the spectrum is not necessarily flat. You can have one single or a finite number of large eigenvalues.
Ah, it depends on the circuit.
No, I'm not even talking about the circuit.
You just make up some states, right? That has this problem.
Special
states. Yeah.
I'm talking about the state you get from.
Say, yeah, in this case, I think. Right, because I mean, basically, here the finite size correction is what this it's almost like something. Right, if I remember correctly, right? This is the more general case for an unequal bipartitioning of the system, right?
That's a bound.
That's what?
That's a bound.
That's a
lower
that's a lower bound, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Be a larger limit.
Yeah, in the large end limit, yes. But that's a lower bound.
Yeah, for the correction. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, this may be interesting to see. You know, for maybe just for these set of gates that not for the state that you somehow design or you make up, but just for example in this case would be. Yeah.
So for this Clifford gates, mm-hmm. it's important that your subsystem is actually.
Yeah. Well, because yes, but the thing is, okay, we never look at the spectrum when you actually take a bipartitioning in such a way that when the subsystem size is way smaller than anything. Yeah. So I don't really know whether it's flat or not in this case. Which means that whether you have to look at the half system size to look at the to see the distinction
for the case of Clifford gate.
For the case of Clifford, yeah.
That may not be still flat. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So basically, and also by the way, let me just mention. I think if I understand correctly from this result, it's like okay. Rennie alpha entropy is almost maximal for alpha design, but then it doesn't mean that, for example, if you look at the, say, alpha plus one, you're going to see deviation from the maximum, right?
It's possible.
It's possible, but it's not, it's guaranteed. Yeah, no, there exist cases, of course. I mean, then otherwise this the gap doesn't hold. But then it doesn't mean that, for example, for the Clifford group, if you look at your Rennie 4, you're going to see that it deviates.
Actually, for Clifford, not.
Yeah.
You don't see a deviation.
Yeah.
You have
so.
Structure two design that the Ray
mm-hmm.
is not large.
Right.
Clifford actually Ray 4 is still pretty large.
Okay.
Which
yeah.
Is,
so this
is an indication that the Clifford group is very close to the 4 design in many senses.
Okay. I see. Yeah. But yeah, this is just to some clarifications about this thing. The second example that I don't really have time to explain in detail, but basically we, instead of a random unitary circuit, we consider a Hamiltonian evolution in this case, meaning that we actually do a quench starting from a random product state whose time evolution is generated by this, is governed by this Hamiltonian. And then the Hamiltonian we choose is also in 1D. It's a 1D spin chain with an X, X, and Y, Y coupling, and then ZZ is an interaction with the parameter that you can tune, and the random longitudinal field, and then a uniform transverse field. And the nice thing about this model is we can tune all these parameters so that this Hamiltonian feature different dynamical phases. And then, for example, suppose if I forget about the transverse field at the moment, I switch off the delta and this one, and I turn on some randomness in the longitudinal field. And this problem is an Anderson localization problem in 1D. And there, of course, when you do a quench, the entanglement entropy doesn't quite saturate. It basically stops growing up to some correlation length of the some localization length of the single particle wave function. But then you could still look at the entanglement spectrum. It doesn't. You can look at that state after the entanglement entropy saturates, and then you find Poisson in this case. And then if you apply the same disentangling idea, because now each term can be viewed as a single qubit or two qubit gates, and then you just apply the same algorithm, you find that for the Anderson localization case, you can still disentangle the states in a similar way. And the other case we try is like, now suppose if I turn on delta, but very weakly, you're in the many body localized phase. And if delta is strong, then you're in the thermalized phase. And then this orange curve is for thermalized phase. And then you find that when you apply the disentangling algorithm, you don't quite disentangle. And for the MBL case, well, the MBL case is a bit special that I don't know if I want. It's very interesting that if you look at the many-body localized phase, you'll find that the entanglement spectrum, even though the entropy is low, is far away from the maximum. The entanglement spectrum still reaches Vigna-Dyson asymptotically in time. So that if you try to apply this algorithm, disentangling algorithm, you still cannot disentangle the states evolved under the MBL Hamiltonian. This is very different as if you take an eigenstate of the highly excited eigenstate of the MBL Hamiltonian. There you don't see any Vigna-Dyson distribution. So in some sense, this is really a dynamical effect. Whereas the highly excited eigenstates of a Hamiltonian that thermalizes, as long as it's close to the middle of the spectrum, even if an eigenstate, you get to pretty much random matrix theory description. So this is a distinction in these two cases. But I
isn't that many localized states, are they radically connected to the just localized?
I'm not really sure the meaning of adiabatically connected in this case, because it's not really something that you it's not associated some property associated with the ground states. It's no, I think what happens is that in the MBL, even if you perform some local unitaries that turns this thing into a diagonal basis, it remains interacting.
Conserved quantity.
Yeah, there is a conserved quantity, but then, in the Anderson localization, basically you can write as some occupation number of uncorrelated orbits. These are the conserved quantity, but in the MBL, you'll find that you don't just stop there, you have interactions.
They're still localized.
They're still localized, but then they're interacting. So that's going to make a difference, I think. That's actually the reason why, if you look at the entropy growth, you see that the entanglement entropy still grow after you reach the localization length. Yeah. It's the tails that they're interacting. But yeah, this is just a side. This is a summary that I think was the time. Okay, I should skip the summary. Now we want to apply the what we learned in the entanglement spectrum to study this recently very very popular topics of quantum chaos and scrambling. I think I can probably safely say that a precise definition of quantum chaos is still lacking. So one of the early attempts is the so-called random matrix theory description of energy levels. That's the early attempts. And then more recently, people come up with the notions like out of time order correlation functions to probe the so-called butterfly effect, and then also this associated quantum Lyapunov exponents. And okay, here, well, a related notion is the so-called scrambling. Here, what I mean by scrambling is from a quantum information point of view, is that initially localized information becomes undetectable without measuring a significant fraction of the system. And actually, I think Benny was able to correct me about this, because I mean, I know of this work that they show that for unitary channels, a quantum butterfly effect necessarily implies scrambling. So that, well, you can take the butterfly effect or as some you know, as a definition of scrambling. But yeah. But here, scrambling as it is defined, because it talks about information, so this can be captured by the entanglement entropy growth. But now we learn that in addition to reaching maximal entropy, truly chaotic system, if you look at the entanglement spectrum of the final state, it must also reach the Vigna-Dyson distributed entanglement spectrum eventually. Now the question is, like, can we use the distance? Because at the beginning, you start from some product state, and if you look at the spectrum, you only have one singular value that is one, and the others are zero. And then as you evolve, all these singular values start to get in place, and then until it reaches to the desired you know, fixed point distribution. But then along the way, we're going to define a distance from the entanglement spectrum in real time to that Vigna-Dyson distribution. And then we want to use this as a measure of the degree of scrambling. And maybe we wanted to compare among different models that eventually will reach this Vigna-Dyson distribution, and then we see if there is a hierarchy. So the measure of distance that we're trying to use is the so-called KL divergence. KL divergence basically measures the distance between two probability distributions. And suppose you have two, like, say, discrete probability distribution P and Q. And this is how KL divergence is defined. And this is always greater than or equal than zero. And then this is zero when PI is equal to QI, when these two distributions are the same. And now we want to use this KL divergence as a measure. And then we want to compare, you know, the degree of scrambling between different models. But then there is this ambiguity that how would you compare, like, you know, say one system is a spin chain and the other system is a braiding of non-abelian anion. There is no unique or unambiguous way of defining things like a time unit. So we're going to use the following quantity. This is a page limit normalized entanglement entropy. S max is basically the maximum entropy that all these models are going to reach given the system size. And then we're going to use S over S max so that this quantity is always something from between 0 and 1. And then we're going to plot the KL divergence as a function of this normalized entropy. So now if I look at the curve, I take a cut vertically. This one has the meaning, the difference in the KL divergence has the meaning that the degree of scrambling of different systems at the same amount of entropy. This is how you should interpret this distance for the same ratio of entropy. And now, of course, the entropy is going to grow so that the time direction goes this way under unitary evolution. So this is the thing that, this is the final plot that we're trying to generate. Eventually, I'm going to just show you one plot, but just bear with me for a few minutes. I'm going to explain the models that we are trying to study. So now we want to study something because, I mean, as far as we know, nobody has studied this notion of chaos and scrambling in systems of non-abelian anions under braids, because this is also related to notions like, you know, universal quantum computing and things like that. And in this case, we only focus on truly chaotic systems because, I mean, we want to compare things that all reach Vigna-Dyson distribution in the end, so forget about Poisson at the moment. And then it turns out that this thing is related to topological quantum computation. And the two models we're studying is the first one is Majorana fermions, and the second one is Fibonacci anions. And by the way, Fibonacci anions is known to be able to do universal quantum computation, but not Majorana fermions. So for Majorana fermions, we're going to do something else. This is just a circuit. Okay, let me skip this one.
Why Why should I believe those models are chaotic?
Sorry?
Why should I believe those models are chaotic?
Oh, it's chaotic in the same sense that you know, you evolve the state under a unitary circuit capable of universal quantum computing, meaning that you can approximate any random states.
Why is that chaotic?
It's chaotic. Well, it's okay. Maybe I should say that for states that will eventually reach a hard random state.
That's not chaotic, right? It could happen very slowly. That's exactly the opposite of what you mean by chaotic. Gremlin is a rapid onset.
Yeah.
There's some infinite time limit.
No, but these are not infinite time limits. Nothing here is infinite time limit. Yeah, but here, if you're, I mean.
In the sense of a random circuit rate, I should saturate a lower bound and have to be a conversion to the inside.
Mm-hmm.
A universal system, you just say that in like an infinite time, I'll form k design.
Why would it be infinite time?
No, I'm just saying there's no, you're not saturating the lower bound. You got to test the system to saturate the lower bound. Like a linear bit.
Okay, so here, what I really mean is that the states that actually reach are random states, or random unitary circuits that are capable of doing that. And it turns out that this one is actually more efficient in doing that than the H plus T and plus C naught. So if you believe that one, you can call chaotic, or you don't like that as well.
How quickly do I form like a K design or?
Mm-hmm. No, here it's
where T is like the depth of the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
How quickly do I form T?
I think for the braids it's not known. Yeah. Yeah, if that's the definition of chaotic that you adopt, then maybe you put a question mark there. But actually what I really mean is that the states that are capable of reaching a hard random states eventually. Okay. So for non-abelian anion systems generated by undergoing random braids, I mean the braiding operation basically it can be described in terms of the braid group, and then you can represent braid operations pictorially on n strands. And then sigma I, basically, if you braid the ith anion with its with the I plus one, and just being careful with the underpassing and overpassing, and then you can also draw a random circuit in such a way that just now for each break wall you have a random braids instead of this one basically works as your unitary logical gates. The first model is actually the Majorana fermions, and these are quasi-particle excitations in the SU2 level 2 Chern-Simons theory. And then, of course, you know that this one is not capable of universal quantum computing. So we're going to do something. Majorana fermions sometimes it's called Ising anions. Basically, they have similar fusion rules. And let me denote the Majorana fermions as gamma. And here the fusion rule would be if you multiply two Majoranas and you define the occupation number of a complex fermions made out of these two Majoranas, and this can be plus one or minus one, which is similar to the two fusion channels of when you're fusing two sigma particles in the Ising CFT. Now, the Hilbert space dimension of two n Majoranas, it turns out to be two to the n minus one, up to minus one because of the Fermi parity, so that the quantum dimension of a single Majorana fermion is actually square root of 2. This is this is an indication of the fact that this is not some tensor product, a simple tensor product of local, some sort of local basis. And in order to do circuits of random braids, you need a representation of a braid group on the Majoranas. And this was done by Ivanov, that sigma the operation sigma I, when you exchange gamma I and gamma I plus 1, can be written in this form, And well, square, this is 1 over square root of 2, 1 plus gamma I plus 1. And well, in order to talk about qubits, of course, we need some local Hilbert space of qubit. So we define the qubits by the occupation number of the complex fermions made out of 2 Majoranas. And then you can basically, you can obtain the operation of this braiding on the on the occupation number basis. And well, if you braid, if the 2 Majoranas being braided are belonging to the same qubit, basically this is a phase gate. This is a, like a phase rotation. And if you're braiding 2 Majoranas that belongs to 2 different qubits, basically you generate the 2 qubit entangling gates. And now with these, you can basically, these are now your elementary gates. And then you can construct the circuit. But then the problem is, like, we know that Majoranas are not sufficient to create circuits capable of universal quantum computation. And actually, if you look at the unit trace, because that's the unit trace of the braiding, this is like this is quadratic in gamma, it's like a free fermion system. So in order to reach maximum entropy and the Vigna-Dyson distributed entanglement spectrum, you need to supplement that with some random local four-body interactions. So basically, we add this term of four Majorana interaction term, but it's not an all-to-all interaction. It's just it basically just couples 4 adjacent Majoranas. Then you randomly sprinkle that on your circuit, and then this model, then this system is capable of reaching maximum entanglement entropy and also Vigna-Dyson distribution.
It means it's different from the Clifford gates that you talked about.
What?
You talked about the Clifford gates before. Clifford algebra.
This one?
So this is better than that.
Mm. Yes. Yes.
Better than always quite something.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Actually, by braiding Majoranas, I think you can alone. You can generate Clifford group. Uh-huh. And the other model is the so-called Fibonacci anion, and here, the particle content, the anion content is very simple. It's basically, well, when you have 2 tau particles and they fuse to either identity or a tau, and now the Hilbert space in this case is defined in this sort of a fusion chain. Now imagine for each leg sticking out, you have a tau particle. Now for the states on the horizontal line, it could be either an identity or a tau. So we basically use this as a labeling for our local Hilbert space. And now the 2 taus at the boundaries can be viewed as some sort of global boundary conditions. And then it turns out the Hilbert space dimension for n plus 1. I think it's n plus 1. Yeah. Or n plus 1 Fibonacci anions is given by the Fibonacci number. And then if you look at the quantum dimension, it's the golden ratio. So again, this one is not some tensor product of some local Hilbert space. And braiding of Fibonacci anions alone turns out that because that's SU2 level 3, they're sufficient for universal quantum computation. And now in the same way, now what we need is an operation of a braiding acting on the local Hilbert's the qubit basis. And it's easy to see that when you do a braid, it's only going to affect the states that are connected to the two tau particles that are being braided. And then the action of this one you can compute using because this is basically a fusion tree rotated by a certain angle using the F matrices to change into a basis where these two fuse into a different a fixed fusion channel, and then you perform the R matrix and then you bring it back. So basically, this is the result that you exhaust all possibilities, and now these are your states and your gates and its action on the state.
We're still considering mm-hmm. random
yes, yes.
staggered
layers, right?
3 qubit gates.
Yes.
3 qubit gates.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is the one last slide before the results. Of course, then you could say, well, the circuits of random braids because nobody looked at this. But then we could as well compare to other models. I'm gonna cross out the chaotic to other models that all reach the Vigna-Dyson distribution and the maximum entropy. And we're gonna compare with the universal sets of gates that people usually talk about, and then also the 2 qubit hard random unitary circuits that people do a lots of study. In the context of random circuits, and also the SYK model, which is fully connected and believed to be maximally chaotic. And then this is a plot that we obtained, basically the thing that that I just showed previously. On the horizontal axis, I have x over s over s max, which is the normalized entropy. And on the vertical axis, I have the KL divergence for different systems. And then first, you can see that, okay, prior to a certain point, there is indeed a hierarchy in this distance to the Vignette-Dyson distribution among different models. This is the first thing that you notice. And then if you look at this thing, the blue curve on the very top turns out to be the H and T and C NOT gates. And then this one, the yellow curve, is the two-qubit Hara random. But then if you look at the braiding of Fibonacci anions, you find that this one is actually very close to a two-qubit Hara random. I mean, the KL divergence to a qubit Hara random unit trace. And in particular, this one is you could say that this one scrambles more efficiently than the usual universal sets of gates that people are using. And then the next thing that you realize is that up to a certain point, all these curves collapse, and they seem to show similar behavior at the at the final period of time evolution. Which, I mean, this is an observation, but we don't really have a more understanding than what we observe in here. Let me just mention one thing, because here, since we're comparing different models by the normalized entropy, so the effect is the presence of this hierarchy. It cannot be viewed as a difference in the circuit depth, because we know that in order to make the unit trace corresponding to the Fibonacci anion, you would need many layers of H and T and C naught. But here, it's not in real time or in circuit depth. It's basically normalized by the entropy. So it's really looking at the distance at the same amount of entropy.
Mm-hmm. All of these are disorder average?
Yes.
You take random, how many random instances?
I think it's either 500 or 1,000. Yeah, because these you can do many realizations. You don't have to diagonalize a Hamiltonian.
Right. And then you check the increasing the disorder or the number of realizations that mm-hmm. Some things converge really slowly to the true disorder.
That I have to say that I didn't check that systematically, but the convergence. But I personally don't believe that it's going to change.
Also, SYK in your definition isn't like, I mean, SYK won't generate Hara randoms.
Okay. There is an energy conservation constraint because you have a Hamiltonian system.
You average over disorder. Your disorder average is not energy conservation.
No. For each realization you do have energy conservation.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So for each realization, it's not gonna reach a truly Hara random state.
Really related. From the point of view that
or in some way you could say that
Hamiltonians does not form like
right. It's basically the same thing as saying you say take e to the minus I H T, this one doesn't this one is not a Hara random unit.
No, there are some ensembles of
mm-hmm.
We'll have time scales where you form our
random
mm-hmm. answer,
mm-hmm.
but that's not every.
Okay.
So it's not related.
Okay.
Yeah, in the late time limit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you're telling me for these Majorana and Fibonacci circuits, mm-hmm. Ensemble, like analytically, I should expect that ensemble average the ensemble of unitaries,
mm-hmm.
right, generated by taking random instances.
Mm-hmm. I should only say that I know for sure is like eventually all these states are going to reach Vignette-Dyson distribution in terms of the spectrum, but you know, I think that there are certain order of designs that basically they are not truly Hara random, but when you look at the entanglement spectrum you won't be able to tell. I think that order has only to be like logarithmic in the system size. So I'm not saying that I shouldn't say I shouldn't emphasize too much about these states being hard random. It's just I'm saying that the entanglement spectrum is not able to tell. Okay, that's more precise. Thanks.
Zizek, maybe we can wrap up.
This is the last one.
Okay,
of course. Oh, sorry. Second last one. Let me just mention one thing. Okay. You know, usually people sort of associate the quantum chaos to the, you know, the computational complexity. And now in terms of the Fibonacci anions, used to do is they try to compile out of the Fibonacci anions, out of braiding Fibonacci anions, the universal set of gates. And this is, for example, I'm even showing a figure that this is how you make a C0 gate out of the Fibonacci anions. And this is extremely complicated. But then from the results, we were seeing that in some sense, the Fibonacci anions, braiding Fibonacci anions is in fact, in some sense, a more efficient way of scrambling than the universal sets of gates. So from the point of view of topological quantum computing, you could say, well, maybe there is a more clever way of utilizing the computational power of braiding non-abelian anions, at least for certain purposes. So this is a side remark from this result. And that's the last slide. Thank you.
Yeah, so there were many questions, but there are a couple more.
So in my random matrix, usually also think in for characteristics, also think about like the not just the like nearest neighbor,
mm-hmm.
Spacing, so that would be very local for this, but correlations across the spectrum. Have you thought about universal correlations in the entanglement?
We didn't do okay. In the case of the random unitary circuit, I think this is not my work, but I think my advisor, and then they also look at the something called the rigidity. I think that's a probe of long-range correlation function. And also by some other people in the that they compute the spectral form factor, which is basically some correlation functions that probes the, you know, more than the local properties of the random matrix theory ensemble. And then it seems like it's going to converge to random matrix theory description. Yeah. And also we look at the density of state. Especially in this case, I didn't talk about that, but it's going to reach a Marchenko-Pasteur distribution if you construct a Wishart matrix out of the states. And then we confirm that as well for Hamiltonian systems that basically thermalizes.
So you think that probably for most chaotic systems, that could be entangled, but it's the same, right?
Yeah, we don't know of any contradictions or exceptions so far. Yeah.
Chaos question. I just got some conclusion that any universal is at this. So of course here it has geometry. It's not like SYK kind of chaos, right? And I remember some conclusion about saying something like any universal is at will achieve basically the same scaling of design type or something like that. So in principle, you know the gates, you know the distribution. In principle, you can write down the Markov chain.
Yeah, Fernando's paper, one of them, the second T to the 10th power, the same balance, it's like T to the 10th, so we call it, and we all give some piece design order.
I was thinking briefly about it. I cannot think of any reason that if it's a universal gate set, it converges to hard measure, it gives you a slower scaling.
All right, let's thank you.